Good morning. Well, I'm glad to see all of you. I'm glad to be here. Pastor Mark is on vacation, so I'm filling in. And those of you that, I guess probably the people that were going to the funeral have already left, but that's been on my heart heavily the last couple of days, is probably for many of you as well. And so we're going to be continuing on with our series that we've been talking about Old Testament. We've been looking for New Testament themes in the Old Testament, because oftentimes we read the Old Testament in a way that lets us get this impression that it's a completely different deal and it's a different message when you get to the New Testament. And so we're tying those pieces together for you. So today we're going to look at Isaiah chapter 6, but I want you to do an exercise first. Are we up there? All right. Take your handout and open it up, and right here, you see it says exercise. So we're going to do that first, okay? So you got to use your imaginations for this exercise. Imagine you're in a restaurant. You're sitting in a restaurant, and while you're standing at the salad bar, the announcement is made that Jesus has returned and is coming into the room any second. Okay? So just put yourself there. Your favorite restaurant. Just envision you're thinking of the meal. You're into that, and you get that message. Jesus has returned, and he's going to come in the door any second. All right? All right. Instinctually, your first response, what do you do? Which one of the following statements would best represent your instinctual response? Don't overthink it. Just what's your instinctual response? A, you run to him and you embrace him. B, you stand there and you kind of wait to see how he looks at you before you make your first move. And C, you duck down, you hide behind the salad bar, and you hope that he didn't see you. If you've got a pen, go ahead, mark it down, A, B, or C. I'll give you a moment while I rearrange a few of my props. All right. Well, we'll come back to this, don't worry. We are in Isaiah chapter 6. This is a very significant time in the history of the nation of Israel and Judah in the Old Testament. And how we're going to approach this time this morning, we're actually going to divide it into three sections. I'm going to give you some background information that will kind of help you understand the passage. And then we're going to stop, and I'm going to come down, and we're just going to talk about it together. And I've got the verses printed on your sheet, so even if the print's a little bit small here and you can't see it too well, you can still look at it here. So we're going to spend some time talking about what do you see in this passage. And it may relate to some of the things that I brought up, and it may be some other things that you noticed and thought about. So that'll be kind of the middle section. And then the last section, I'll draw some themes together and summarize it. And so that's our plan going forward. So let me give you a little bit of background, first of all. And starts with this phrase right at the top there about King Uzziah died. So who is this King Uzziah? What was going on during that time? King Uzziah was a good king. Overall, he had a great reputation. He did a lot of good things. But actually, he was the king during the time that the nation was in a decline. This was a good king, and the things were in the process of getting bad. They were going to worse. And realize Isaiah is talking here, and Isaiah is a prophet. So Isaiah is someone who has been gifted to speak for God about what is going to be happening. So you've got this situation where a good king, he was young when he became a king. He had a lot of military successes. Really innovative guy. Those of you that are technical, maybe like that kind of thing, this guy was known for his innovations in military technology, in agriculture, digging wells, planting vineyards. He was close friends with Isaiah. In fact, he may have been a relative of Isaiah. So I want you to get the connection about how Isaiah must have been processing this experience of King Uzziah dying. So there's a lot of good things that were happening with Uzziah, but there's this big thing at the end of his life. Because in the midst of all this good that Isaiah had done and all of the contributions that he had been made, and him, and he was even in Jesus' lineage, he became prideful, and beyond his social influence, his political power, and all of that, he wanted to have this spiritual influence too. And so he, out of his pride, he crossed the line and he went into the inner chamber to burn incense to act like one of the holy people, one of the priests, they were called. So because he disregarded God's law and God's design for that, and because of his pride, he was struck with leprosy. And the irony of that is that that not only kept him from doing those inappropriate things, the things that only the priests were to do, but that excluded him completely from any of the temple life from that point on. So that last portion of his life, he really lived in isolation, and he was buried in isolation. So it was a great guy. He had done a lot of good things. People mourned for him because of all the positive things he did, but he had a bad ending. So imagine you were Isaiah, and this just happened. Imagine how you would feel in that situation. I really, as I was studying this and thinking about how the nation was at this period of time, I thought, wow, that's a bunch of how I feel about America. I feel there's a number of things about our nation that are not going in a, you know, the things are, we've peaked out, we're going down. And that's disturbing. So as much as you can, enter into what Isaiah must have been feeling when this event happened. Now, I want to give you a couple other pieces of background that are pretty significant, and I think as Americans, we often would forget it. And it's related to a bunch of the other words in this passage here. You notice there's this holy, holy, holy. We don't understand holy very well, so I want to dig into how does this whole holy thing worked. And then you notice there's this piece of Isaiah recognizing God's holiness, and he feels that he needs a huge amount of cleansing. So he is really unclean. So there's a piece of unclean that we want to do it. And you may have guessed that we were going to talk about clean from all of my props up here. Actually, I was telling Vicki, I said, I asked Philip if I could get some clean room stuff, you know, from the medical world, and if he'd bring it, and I was hoping I could dress him up in it. But he's gone this weekend, so just had to hang it up here and not have a real dummy. Philip, if you're listening to that, don't take it wrong. Anyway, so there's this piece of cleansing that is needed, and then this cleansing happens in this story. And we're going to go into the text of it. So what is this whole unclean, clean dynamic that happens? So what does all that mean? And from an Old Testament perspective, and then from now, how do we, those themes, how do they relate to our life here now? And then you see at the end, this remarkable turnaround where Isaiah is just, yeah, hey, pick me, and here am I, send me. And God tells him to go. And what's behind all that? How do we connect to that today? So let's talk about this dynamic of these clean, unclean, holy, and common. One of the books I was reading talked about, you know, these four categories are really the building blocks of the basic spiritual universe as described by the Old Testament. And if we get our minds around these things, it really can enable us to grasp a lot of the stuff we'll read in the Old Testament. So they were instructed to be very specific about these four categories, clean, unclean, holy, and common. When you talked about unclean, you see that in a lot of different ways. I think probably the most graphic thing that we hear about was two areas. One was this dynamic of leprosy, and how lepers, when they would get that horrible skin disease, and you'd see the disfiguring that they would experience, they would be excluded from the camp, and they would have to live apart. And they would have to even call out, I'm unclean, I'm unclean. And what a horrible life that must have been. But then there's the the uncleanliness that was experienced in their relationship with of the practice of their religion, and all of the dynamics that were involved in addressing so that they would be able to practice their Jewish religion during that time. But when we bridge to that thought today about what is that experience of unclean, it brings in, it's helpful to bring in just this whole cloud of words that are all related to that concept of what it means to be unclean. And frankly, I would lay a lot of money on the table saying every one of us regularly experiences this dynamic of unclean. In fact, this is a major driver for all of our actions, or for a lot of our actions. This aspect of being excluded or rejected or unwanted or different or untouchable or unworthy or ugly, disgusting, contaminated, outsider. If you roll back through your life and you think of experiences that you had, I've been pondering the junior high experience. I think, wow, what the powerful messages of this that are ramped up in our school system. And then there's so many things that we do throughout all of our lives so that we can prevent ourselves from being in those categories. And you know, as I have up here with a variety of our cleaning products, we've got things that we do to try and make ourselves clean. In fact, this morning before coming, I brushed my teeth. I showered, washed my hair, I shaved, put on deodorant. I won't tell you all the other things I did, but there's a lot of things that we do every day to be clean or to cover ourselves when we fear that we may not be clean or may not be perceived. So the air fresheners, the perfumes, all the colognes, those kind of things. There is a lot of our economy, there is a lot of our daily preoccupations that are tied up with this whole aspect of unclean and to be clean. There's a core idea that is tied to this uncleanness, and is this experience of shame. And of course, that shame goes back to Genesis chapter 3, and that whole idea of hiding when we experience shame ties right into that as well. So as much as you can, I encourage you in your own story, in your own life, go back to where you remember that experience of shame. And then you can connect a little bit of what this idea of unclean is that we're talking about here. And that every time in this dynamic, we're just driven to do something to hide, to cover up. And that's our human condition. That's what our life is like right now. And there's a lot of social things that we have in our history and in our present that relate to this creating unclean versus clean, two classes of systems, of things like that. And so this whole segregation aspect of our history is a part of it. And so this dynamic of unclean is huge. So as difficult as it is, as this experience of unclean is, I want you to think of the polar opposite. And that's what the clean dynamic is. That clean is this category that God gives us that just is, everything is right in the world. I'm not excluded. I'm welcomed in. In fact, I'm confident. I can stand before you. I can stand before anybody, and I don't have to be worried. I don't have to say, ooh, I wonder if my fly's up. I don't have to do any of that. I can just be confident. I can just walk forward and just contribute with the way that I've been gifted to contribute. So I'm relaxed. It's just a freedom. Do you feel that? Can you connect with that longing in your heart to live like that? Just to have that freedom. That's what God has designed for us. So there's a lot in the Old Testament that talks about how do you go from unclean to clean, and that God is really concerned about that. God cares about that. God takes that very seriously. So we have this theme talked about throughout the Old Testament, various things about how to purify. And in some of the ways, there was animal sacrifices that really gave us the indication that this is not an easy thing. This is a costly thing in order to go from unclean to clean. There were other rituals and activities to think about how all that happened. And I think as I bring this up to our date today, what is my perception? What is our culture's perception of clean? I think our culture perceives clean as cool. If I'm cool, I'm okay. I can be perceived okay, and I'm going to be accepted in. And Isaiah, later in the book, has this really harsh statement. He says, "We have all become like one who is unclean, and all our righteousness is like a polluted garment." Now, when he says all our righteousness, you can substitute in there all our activities to make ourselves acceptable, or everything we do to be cool, or everything we do to smell good or to look good, or whatever we do, that's our righteousness. And all of that is like, and he says, a polluted garment. Frankly, that is way under-translated. You've probably heard this in some other messages. It literally is a dirty tampon. It is a dirty menstrual cloth. And so our best acts to look cool, to be cool, to feel good, is comparable to a dirty tampon. That's shocking, but that's the truth. And I appreciate him not holding anything back about that. Wow, what a predicament we're in. What a situation. What do we do about that? How do we handle that? And you know, it's even worse than that, because it's so easy to be defiled. You know, in the Old Testament, you could be defiled just by touching something or something touching you that was defiled. I mean, clean things couldn't make unclean things clean. Clean things got unclean because they came in contact with dirty things. It happens with us too. In fact, Debbie was at the, I was going to get a whole big bag of this, but I didn't. She was at the garden show. You know about this Nampa company, the poop natural dairy compost? I grew up on a dairy farm, and so I kind of like poop. But I thought this was pretty cool that they came up with a company that's all based on this idea, this playing off our sensitivity about being unclean. It says, oh, I pooped my pants. Plants. I pooped my plants. You know, and they almost got on the Super Bowl commercial thing for this. And I was going to open this package, and then I was going to bring it down and ask if some of you could kind of take a pinch out and verify that it's really okay. I didn't think I'd get too many volunteers. I do have some hand sanitizer that we could take care of later, which is one of our strategies to be clean. But this just brings up our sensitivity about cleanliness. I remember growing up, it was real important. Hey, after you get done in the barn, you take a shower before you go to school. Otherwise, you know how the kids would look at you because they would be smelling you. That's part of our experience here. It's so easy to be defiled. And you know, when we are defiled, we're defiled both from what we do, and we're also defiled from what others do to us. And that is a scary thing. In fact, when we're talking about shame and we're realizing this experience of shame, so many times people experience shame because of what someone else has done to them. We think of situations of rape or sexual abuse or all kinds of other abusive situations where you become unclean in your own experience because of something that is done to you. So both of these pick up, both of us generate shame in us. But it's important for us to realize that not both of them are tied to guilt, even though you may feel guilty. But we can be put in this unclean shame experience because of what we do and what others do to us. So let's jump to the third building block there, and that's the common. And actually, I'm not going to spend much time on this because basically common is either unclean or clean. And common is understood in contrast with holy. So if you think you've got clean, unclean, and you've got holy and common. And often when we think of common, and this is a misconception of our American perspective, we think of the word secular, and we think sacred and secular. But that's a misconception, because in God's way of thinking about things, there really isn't any sphere in which he does not have domain. He is appropriate to be king in every area. So that our normal way of thinking secular is not biblical. So how does this holy piece relate to all the rest? What happens about that? And this is the good news, because the whole story of the Bible tells us how the holy is focused on addressing the entirety of what leads us to becoming unclean. And that's called the gospel. And we have a picture, a forerunner of the picture in this story. And as we talk about it in a couple minutes, we can look at that a little bit. But we are living on the other side of Jesus' time on earth. And so we can see and we can experience this entirety of what God accomplishes in addressing our shame through the gospel. And it's important to realize you've got both sides of that, both what we have done and those things that others have done to us. And so the work of the gospel is to address the entirety of the experience of our shame, the entirety of the experience of how we have been sinned against and been shamed and soiled, as well as how we have through our own sinfulness and our own responses. God's renovation, his restoration project, the whole work that he accomplishes, and I'm going to make a comment, those are bright yellow on my screen. So sorry, you guys get the whatever that color is. But God's design is to transform our experience from that horrible dynamic of living as unclean people to people who are just thoroughly surrounded and nurtured, and just this emotionally rich situation, this emotionally rich experience of being a beloved child of God, of being greatly loved by him, of being worth his holy son, Jesus, dying on the cross. This experience of being completely forgiven, of being secure, of realizing individually that God is especially fond of me. God is especially fond of you. Let that in. That's really the truth of the gospel, that there's no condemnation because everything that needed to be done was accomplished on the cross. And even better, that God saw our situation and he knew we were powerless, and so he took the initiative. What a beautiful, beautiful thing to realize that God takes the initiative to fix the problem that we experience. And as Rock shared last week in the communion time, God is for us. God is for us. What a counterintuitive thing for most of us to realize, wow, God is for us. So that powerful dynamic, once all of that is in place, then comes this last piece. God makes us his ambassador. God says, yeah, I can pick you. Go ahead and do it. God knows completely our condition. He knows completely what he has done. He's completely relaxed to delegate to us, to give us a job. And that's so empowering, and that's so encouraging. Okay, so the clean, becoming holy, that process is sanctify, and I'm not going to take time on that. But I want to mention one more thing before I give you guys a chance to dig into the passage. And that is, in the Old Testament time, there was this very real recognition that if something, an unclean thing, came into the presence of the holy God, it meant death. Exodus 33, you cannot see my face, for man shall not see me and live. And you can go, there's multiple stories that talk about that happening. So when Isaiah experienced what we're going to read about, that was a scary dynamic, because I'm sure he was thinking of all of these other things that happened in the past, and he said, I'm a goner. You know, this is serious business. I'm about to breathe my last breath. So, all right, now it's your turn. Take your paper, or if you can read up there, it's a bit small, especially if you're my age. And let's talk about it. So what do you see in these nine verses? And I'm going to try and repeat. Say it loud so I can hear it. I got a little bit of hearing problem. I'll kind of repeat it so it gets on the recording. What do you see there? And I can read through it or let you guys read it. What would you like? You, okay, Glenn wants me to read through it. That means I'm going to put my glasses on. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting upon a throne, high and lifted up, and the train of his robe filled the temple. Above him stood seraphim, each had six wings. With two he covered his face, and with two he covered his feet, and with two he flew. And one called to the other and said, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory." And the foundations of the thresholds shook at the voice of him who called, and the house was filled with smoke. And I said, "Woe is me, for I am lost. I'm desolate, I'm despicable, I'm perishing. For I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips. For my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts." Then one of the seraphim flew to me, having in his hand a burning coal that he had taken with tongs from the altar. And he touched my mouth, and he said, "Behold, this has touched your lips. Your guilt or your iniquity is taken away, and your sin atoned for." And I heard the voice of the Lord saying, "Whom shall I send, and who will go for us?" And I said, "Here am I, send me." And he said, "Go." What strikes you about this passage? Yeah, Josh. Okay. You're a teacher. I suppose you can ask questions because that's what teachers do.
Well, the holy, 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 is there like recognition of God in his entirety? Is that why they always say that in the Greek like that?
Well, that's a good observation. There's a significance to the three. As I was reading about it, you know, in Hebrew, when you repeat something, it's for emphasis. And this is very unique that it's repeated three times. So it's like amplified. So this is like the holiest, you know, so it's the maximum holy of holies. Now, there might be something about the Trinity in there too. I mean, that's kind of a cool thing. I hadn't thought about that, but yeah. So that the piece is this maximum holiness though. Yeah. So another question, follow-up question. Yeah, now the verbal, you're talking about a verbal confession, you mean after that?
Well, when he says, "I'm a man of unclean lips," and he recognizes that, and then he.
Yeah.
And then the angel comes to him with this.
Yeah, and that's a cool thing. So basically, Isaiah here is confessing. He's recognizing, and really, confession is recognizing what God already knows. But and that's a nice bridge to 1 John 1, where if we confess our sins. And that whole dynamic. So yeah, Isaiah's doing that. He's saying, "Wow, look at me," and then he's saying it. This is what I am like. Yeah, Bob. Yes, you come to the presence of God, and all of a sudden you see yourself. It's like coming into a light, and all of a sudden you see how dirty you are. Is it? Yeah, right. I mean, that happens to me. You come and you see the light. And say, "Oh wow, I guess I am dirty." Yeah. I mean, we have lights on our mirrors in our bathroom so that you can see. Yeah. What else do you think about? What do you notice? Yeah, Billy. Yeah. The seraphim recognize their limitations. That's pretty amazing to think about. Yeah. They had to cover their feet. They covered, yeah. In fact, somebody said there wasn't, God filled the room. They couldn't even land, you know. They had to hover. Yeah. There's a lot of richness, I think, in the picture as you think about it. Bob? Yeah. So Isaiah has this statesman. He's connecting not only for himself, but for his nation, and of course recognizing the state of this nation as well. Yeah. Okay.
Just the train of the robe signifies
the
man.
Yeah. beyond long. You know, I just feel there's not enough words. The train of his robe is it just the majesty. There's not enough words to explain everything. And if I was Isaiah, I couldn't come up with enough words. That's an awesome thought. And when you're talking about any of the passages that are discussing God, we don't have words to talk about it. So we fundamentally are going to be limited in our ability to describe that. God is always more. Bill? So this is amazing. This, how in the world did Isaiah make this rapid change from being completely exposed to not just be willing but free and open about volunteering and, you know, pick me, pick me. Wow. So what, unpack that. Think about how do you think that happened? What was the operative part of that transition? So there had to be some real powerful forgiveness work that happened, that he experienced. It wasn't just something mentally, but it really soaked through the fabric of his being. Somebody over here? Heather? Yeah. Yeah. So he really experienced a complete relief. And you mentioned the guilt there. And actually, some translations use guilt. Guilt is kind of an inadequate word, the way we often think about it for the idea that's here. It's really the completeness of his experience of uncleanness. Yeah, Mike? Huh. Yeah. So a couple pieces here. I got to make sure I repeat it. The coal from the altar, and you don't see an aspect of faith that, you know, Isaiah recognized his need, but the initiative happened, and then the action was carried by the seraphim. Yeah. Did I get all that? You know, this is a powerful piece here to realize God takes the initiative, and there was a complete process that happened in that. I just think that's beautiful, and I had another thought, and I can't think of what it was right now related to that. Maybe it'll come to me. I read a whole bunch in preparation for this, but I'm getting old. I don't remember everything now. Josh?
Well, I was just thinking,
another question?
It's more of a statement.
A statement this time. Okay, good.
It's kind of on the idea of Israel rejecting God as their king, and just the uncertainty, since he mentions it the first where he's, you know, it was after King Uzziah died, well, what's going to happen to our nation?
Yeah.
And then in 5, like, first of all, he sees God in his glorious splendor, but then he says, but I've seen the king.
The king, yes. So the superlative king.
That they're okay, I guess, maybe.
So that's a cool piece. So, okay, worried at first, sees the real king, and so I think it's really cool. God is not worried. Yeah, I mean, God's on his throne, firmly on his throne, and
maybe that's part of his complete transformation, is understanding who God is.
So the complete transformation includes seeing who God is and how that changes our perspective on our current troubling situation, the things that are they're making us feel worried. One more, and then I have to get going because I always go over time, and I got a couple other things I want to wrap it up with. Well, good. Oh, yes, Carly. How what? So what Carly is saying is amazing, the willingness that he had to go. Just here am I, he's just open-hearted. What about that is the most curious thing for you? Uh-huh. Yeah, it was like a rapid transition. And there's this dynamic of saying, it's not only willingness, but that I can really do that. And I can really feel confident to volunteer, because all of my experience of volunteering has been prideful. Or somehow I want to impress people. So, yeah, I'll serve God. And I hope you're watching me say that. You know? So there's open-heartedness. This freedom is just remarkable. Yeah. I think it all fits together. Sure, go ahead. Yeah. Yeah, I can't give you, I'll just give you my impression on that. And it comes from that, you know, the out of the heart, the mouth speaks. So there's a perception of uncleanness. He's a prophet. He's a speaker. That's a main dynamic. So there's a perception that uncleanness that's relevant to the situation. And he's about to be told that he's got a job of speaking to do, and a tough speaking job. So, okay, I'm unclean. This is how I'm currently processing my uncleanliness. I think it's good not to be too mechanistic in how you approach it. I think it's good to say, okay, God knew what he was experiencing, and the cleansing was appropriate to Isaiah. And that's all part of God taking the initiative and God's ability of just addressing us exactly where we're at and what we need. I just think there's a real beauty in that whole piece. But there's a lot of stuff to dig in here that I encourage you to be doing more about it. But I'm going to be going overtime again, so big surprise there. Matt already coached his people. That might happen. Okay, let's just take and look at some phases that happened in this as we kind of wrap up our looking at this. I really think we have here a sequence of discipleship, a way of looking at what Isaiah experienced and then bridge it to what our experience of discipleship, and maybe even do some troubleshooting in terms of where are we at in our own lives. So phase one, we experience some life situations, some difficulties, something that makes us say, and it's a disorienting, it's a destabilizing situation that we experience. That kind of wakes us up. And then the next piece that Isaiah had, which was remarkable, was his vision, his seeing a God-centered reality, that God was still on the throne, and God wasn't worried, and that just completely reorganized the whole way that Isaiah experienced and saw the destabilizing situation. It gave a perspective to him, and then he realized, oh no, as I look at this holy God, on one hand, it's great that he's not worried, but then I see what the light reveals in me. And so Isaiah had this deep, scary experience of being unworthy and his own inadequacy, his own personal sin was there. And he even processed that as, I'm going to be extinguished. But then this beautiful, appropriate, complete cleansing that he received. And for us, that's the gospel. That's the significance of the gospel. And that's what Isaiah's cleansing was, looking forward to the complete cleansing that God worked through the cross. And so that's that beautiful step there. Then the ending is where, as Carly was talking about, there's this freedom that Isaiah had to say, yeah, I'll be your ambassador, not out of pride, but just to say, let me help. I'm just delighted. And then, of course, God ended with the go, which is this confirmation of God saying, yes, you're there. I want to deploy you. So I kind of put it into my words. I'd say this destabilizing situation, oh, no, now what do we do? And then, hey, look, God's not worried. That's pretty cool. And then, whoa, I'm even more sinful than what I realized before. I am much worse off than I ever perceived in my own understanding of my lacking. And then there's this phase four, this amazing, the gospel is better news than I ever imagined. You know, that pairing is really key. You're worse off than you think you are, but the gospel is better news than you ever thought it was. And keep those two together. And Isaiah had them together there. And then from pretense to pride, you can be free. My efforts are not about earning anyone's favor, including earning God's favor, because I already know that God is for me. That's already settled. So I can have this, yeah, pick me, because I can just be free to do it. It's like a child's willingness to help out. And that's a beautiful picture there. So that whole middle piece, that's the key part for the transformation that happens there, and that whole dynamic. And I think a good diagnostic is to see, is your heart free to say, hey, here am I, pick me, without pride or without that pretension? And if it's not, that's a good thing to give you some indication. Maybe there's some deeper work you need to do on some of those interim steps. So, you know, if your emotions are indicating something else other than that freedom, if your emotions are indicating maybe anger, if they're indicating maybe pride, and others may help you identify that, even your own awareness of anger may not be as well as if you ask those people around you if you are an angry person. I'm speaking from personal experience there. I was surprised when I was asking, you know, what are kind of some of my dominant negative emotions? And in conversation with Debbie, it said anger. And I think, wow, I wouldn't have perceived that I had anger issues, but I guess I can see that now. But I needed her to help me. Another piece is false humility of I really can't do anything for God because I'm not gifted, I'm not capable, and really that's a lot of it is covering for there is a sense of our shame, there's a sense of our unworthiness, of our inner filth that we're still reckoning with. And basically, if that's still there, we haven't fully processed the gospel. We haven't recognized the depth of what Christ has done, the thoroughness of the gospel. So that false humility and or anxiety. If you've got anxiety, what am I worried about if God is on the throne? And if God has accomplished this incredible gospel transformation for us? So let me play this out. So you got a destabilizing situation. You have a problem happening, and you're put into some. How do I handle this? What am I going to do? If a dysfunctional pattern, how does this go? Phase two, small God. You don't see a big God, but you see a small God, and you say, you know, in practice, I act like God is inadequate, like he's distracted with other things. Maybe he's unaware of my situation. He's disinterested. He's incapable or uncaring. And you know, I really don't think God will properly handle this situation on his own. I really got to do some stuff. Now, we would never say this, but we act this way. And you got to catch yourself acting this way to realize that you're actually believing that. Okay? Phase three, dysfunction. Well, yeah, I'm not perfect, but I make a few mistakes here and there. But, you know, in reality, I'm not that bad. I'm certainly better than many others. And you know, let's just be honest about this situation. If I don't help out, things will be bad. So I gotta step up here. Phase four, dysfunction, a small gospel. You know, I'm really thankful for the forgiveness of my sins of the past, you know, I had kind of a bad youth or whatever, but I can handle it from here on out. Now what is needed is for all of us to serve with greater dedication and effort. We all got to step up. So we have messages about we got to step up, we got to have greater focus, we got to work harder, we got to serve harder. Phase five, dysfunction. Performance, or maybe another way of saying that is just a sense of obligation, that I'm obliged to do something. rather than free, there's this sense of, I need to work hard to act like a good Christian. I need to show God and others my faithfulness. I've got to show it. They got to see it. It's really important that I get that feedback. And, you know, if I'm honest, I feel like God and Jesus are frequently disappointed in me, that they thought I could have done better. And they're okay that I'm on the team, but, you know, there's just this lingering disappointment that they have toward me. Any of those characterize your life? I just encourage you to do a deeper look and say, there's some pieces of the Isaiah transformation that I need. Now we'll jump back to the exercise. And I'm not going to talk about it, but I'll encourage you, when you go home, on the back page, I've got an if you answered A, if you answered B, if you answered C. Spend some time with the Lord unpacking that, processing that, and hopefully that will be helpful in your own understanding of where you're at in terms of that. So we got a wonderful picture of what Isaiah experienced here, what God's desire, what his design for us to move into that full cleanness, that openness, that freedom that was experienced. And I just encourage you to walk away with this with an amazing sense of the gospel and how deep and profound and beyond your expectations. Come on up, worship team. And let that soak into the depths of not only what you think are the answers, but what you feel are the answers and how you respond to your daily situations. So this transition from the woe is me to here am I, send me, is really all about the gospel. It's really all about the gospel. I chose this because it's been something that a verse I've really liked, but I'm recently understanding some new dimensions to it. And I'm going to read it, and then let me just make a couple comments, and maybe Matt's ready already. You're fast. Can I have a minute? Okay. This is from Jeremiah 9:23-24. Let not the wise man boast in his wisdom. Let not the mighty man boast in his might. Let not the rich man boast in his riches. But let him who boasts boast in this, that he understands and knows me, the God who fully knows him. Okay, that's the significance. That word knows is that mutual knowing. It's actually the word know that is used for sexual intercourse. That I am the Lord who practices steadfast love, justice, and righteousness in the earth, for in these things I delight, declares the Lord. When you see boast, boast is the antidote to shame. It shows us what we are using to cover our shame, to address our shame. So let not the wise man cover his shame with his wisdom. Let not the mighty man cover his shame with his might. Let not the rich man cover his shame with his riches. But let him who boasts, let all of us, you know, let us boast that we understand and know the God that knows us. That connection with God. And God knows fully your level of uncleanness. And he invites us to a personal knowledge of walking with him.
All right, I think we're
you can land it.
Why don't you stand with us? We'll close with one last song. Here we go.